This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is writer and Vietnam veteran William Broyles. Until a few years ago, on the surface, William Broyles appeared to be one of the veterans who was able to create a post-war life free of Vietnam nightmares and haunting memories. Being a veteran didn't seem to be an important part of his identity, and certainly the war didn't hold him back professionally. After the war, Broyles worked as founding editor of Texas Monthly, editor of New West magazine, and editor-in-chief of Newsweek. But in 1984, he quit Newsweek and experienced a personal malaise that alerted him to the fact that he still had unfinished business in Vietnam. He believed that to really know himself, he had to know those who had been his enemy. And he had to come to terms with his realization that as much as he hated the war, he missed it in ways that deeply troubled him. Broyles made a solo return trip to Vietnam in 1984 to try to put the legacy of the war in focus. He chronicles the trip in his book Brothers in Arms, which is also his reflection on how war brings out the duality of human nature. It inspires soldiers to heroic acts of self-sacrifice. At the same time, it unleashes the most brutal and sadistic human impulses. Broyles was drafted in 1968, when he was 24, after he completed a fellowship at Oxford University in England. Like most of his college-educated, middle-class friends, he had tried to stay out of the military. I asked William Broyles about when he first realized he hadn't really put the war behind him.
I thought that the war was this sort of increasingly distant memory that I had successfully put behind me and had gone on with my life. But then I went down to the Vietnam Memorial in November of 82, when it was just dedicated in Washington. And it's this long black wall with 58,000 names on it, one for every man and woman killed in the war. And I stood there in front of all those names, and it just struck me that the war for me was not over, that I'd left some little piece of myself over there, and I had to go back and try to get it.
Were there images that kept recurring to you from the war that even though you tried to leave it behind, kept sneaking up into your consciousness?
Oh, sure. I mean, all through these years when I thought I'd put it behind me, I would still have dreams about it. I would still see the strangest moments. I would be standing in line at the bank, and I would see, you know, the face on the floor of someone, you know, like as if they were in a medevac helicopter, or I would be on a bus and see the men that I'd been with. And I had this dream I would continually have about coming back to my old base and being ambushed. But, you know, I have dreams about being a kid, too. You know, so I was trying to say that I sort of told myself, well, this was an intense experience. Yes, it's still with me, but I have to consciously put it behind me, which I really tried to do.
You said that you really didn't want to fight in Vietnam. You didn't want to join the military, but you were drafted. What was your position on the war then? Were you opposed to the war? Or did you
I was opposed to the war. I'd been in the civil rights movement in the South in 63, 64, and led some student demonstrations in 65 before I went off to England. And so I had this sort of political opposition to the war, which I thought justified my continuing to avoid the draft. And I also had my sort of personal ambition, that is, I had my career to get on with, and also I didn't want to get killed. I mean, there was a very, very rational reasons I didn't want to go there. But I remember I was sitting in Oxford watching the Tet Offensive in 1968, and these young Americans were being killed before my eyes on the BBC, and they were just like the young men I'd gone to high school with back in Texas. And it struck me, I mean, I don't know why it took me so long, that no one I knew in college and no one I knew at Oxford was in the war, but that all of these kids I'd known in high school were. And I realized that I had this respect for people who had such strong convictions that they would go to prison or that they would go to Canada because they opposed the war so much, or that they would be conscientious objectors and still serve, but that I couldn't continue this sort of weaselly, mealy-mouthed approach, which was to kind of be a student and not get drafted or to have my doctor fake medical documents for me, that was morally more wrong for me than essentially allowing myself to be drafted and not expecting some other man who was less well-educated to take my place.
When you entered the military, when you joined the Marines, there were two things that set you apart from a lot of the other Marines. One was your high level of education, and the other was your age. You were 24, and as you point out in the book, the average age of people in the infantry in World War II was 24, but in Vietnam the average age was 19. So you were older.
Yeah, they thought I was practically their father. I was out in the when I got to Vietnam. I was just my platoon worked on its own. I never saw anyone above the rank of captain in the war at all. It was just me as a second lieutenant and my 50 or so high school dropouts and other ne'er-do-wells. And they were 19 years old, basically 18, and they hadn't the slightest idea what they were doing there. They just got out of high school. They'd been away from home for the first time, and they were put in the middle of this strange moral universe where they didn't know who their enemy was, where they didn't know what they were fighting for. And for all that, they were really they really rose to the occasion. They were these extraordinary kids. And because I was older, they tended to look up to me after a while, although their main concern at first was whether I would get them killed or not. That was, they weren't interested in my education. I mean, it didn't matter to them where I'd been to college or anything else. They didn't check my resume. They just wanted to make sure I wouldn't lead them into an ambush or not.
Well, why did you want to return? You've said that one of the reasons is that you felt that to know yourself, you had to know your enemy. What, were you having identity problems then? Did you feel like you really needed to know yourself better?
Well, what I'd done in the war and that experience was something which I don't think I'd really confronted in myself. I just sort of pushed it aside and gone on. And the more I talked with the people, the men that I'd fought beside, the more I started realizing these contradictory emotions of pride and loyalty and friendship, as well as these sort of more base emotions of brutality and so on. But that wasn't enough. You know, as much as we were starting to give each other support, which we did in the 80s, there still seemed to be this missing piece, which was, who are these guys on the other side? It was always a mystery to us who we were fighting. You know, our enemies were these abstractions. They were sort of shadows in the night. They could have been the people who were cutting our hair or selling us Cokes during the day. We never knew who they were. So I thought if I could go back and really meet them as human beings, not as abstractions, that I would be able to put the war behind me. That was just my sort of naive but very simple thought that I wanted to do.
You flew first to Hanoi, and which is not where you had fought, and it seemed to me as if you had wanted to first meet the people who had been your enemy. Is that why you went to Hanoi first?
Well, my original idea was just to go to Da Nang, which is in the middle of the country where I'd fought, but you know, my host insisted that I go to Hanoi first, which turned out to be a wonderful thing because I ended up, in a sense, meeting the people back home for them. The people who, in the north, who had sent their sons and daughters south, who had fired the anti-aircraft weapons at our planes, who had been bombed, who had gone down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. In a way, that was where the war was sustained by the Society of North Vietnam.
You must have expected to be treated with a lot of hostility.
Oh, I did. I was worried. In fact, when I first got there, I was. People would look at me with sort of hostile glances, and it scared me. And then I realized, I was told, that they thought I was a Russian and their allies. And when I was able to tell them that I wasn't a Russian but that I was an American, their sort of anger immediately dissolved into sort of smiles and friendliness. They couldn't see me enough. They wanted to ask questions about, you know, my blue jeans, my music. You know, they wanted to hear my tapes.
Well, one of the things that the war brought to Vietnam was rock and roll music.
Sure did.
And it sounds from your book that there's still a lot of it there.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing, the Society of the North that sent its sons down the Ho Chi Minh Trail was like a monastery in a way. They were very, had a monastic existence. They denied themselves any material possessions. You go into those villages, and still today, they're very much, it reminded me of what the States must have been, this country must have been like during the Depression, where everybody suffered, but they had a feeling that they were all doing it for a common good, a common reason. But now, they've conquered the South where we were, but from South Vietnam, their relatives have brought back bicycles, radios, blue jeans, makeup, and these consumer goods, which seem so innocuous in themselves, are completely and utterly destroying this monastic society. Because once one teenager in a village gets a pair of blue jeans, and once one teenage girl gets some makeup, it's all over. Everybody wants it. And this sort of rising expectations of the people of Vietnam for sort of a better life is really a tremendous strain in the country now. In a way, it's very ironic because by defeating South Vietnam, they have brought into their own country this sort of incurable disease that in a way is eating away at the very basis of their communist society.
You were really surprised by the hospitality with which you were welcomed in North Vietnam. But was there underneath this constant sense between you and the North Vietnamese that you had been enemies and there were things that you would maybe never address because it would be too painful and it would bring to the surface the hostilities that you were trying to repress?
Well, I didn't see that very often. But the moment in which I expected it the most was when I was near my old base and I met this woman walking down the road, and she turned out to have been in the Viet Cong. And I asked her, you know, started talking, and her husband had been killed. Well, when? I said, well, 1969. What month? December. Where? Bo Ban Hamlet. And it just struck me that I had been patrolling that area in December of 69. I had been in Bo Ban Hamlet about the same week that her husband was killed, and that I could have killed her husband. And I told her that. It took almost more courage to tell her that than anything I did on the whole trip. And she looked at me, and she didn't blink, and she said, but that was during the war. The war is over. And that was sort of the attitude I had everywhere. And I was able to bring that out of myself, too, because I met men who might have killed people I knew. But I didn't feel any hostility toward them. And they seemed to feel no hostility toward me. And that gave was sort of like a benediction in a way over this whole thing for me, was to be able to meet them, to see that I had no anger left, and to witness that what I thought was their honest saying that they had no anger left either, and bitterness. And it was very purgative to do that.
But some of the people in North Vietnam warned you that when you went to South Vietnam, that you maybe shouldn't be so open in telling them
that
you'd fought in the war. What were the reasons for that?
Well, I think the people in the North felt that the people in the South I would meet might have more intense feelings and might be much more bitter, because after all, that's where the war had been fought. And I thought about that when I first got to the airport in Da Nang. You know, they were asking me what I'd done and where I'd been, and I just decided, well, I'd come, so I might as well be honest. And I said, well, I was in the Marines, and they said, but they forced you to come here, didn't they? I said, no, not really. But you didn't want to fight here, did you? And I said, well, not particularly, but I did. They made you, though, didn't they? They kept wanting somehow to think that I had been sent against my will, and I had to tell them that I really hadn't.
Were there any places that you wanted to visit, places especially that you had been to as a Marine, that still had very intense memories for you, and places that you had emotionally braced yourself for returning to, where you expected this like flood of uncontrolled emotions to take hold of you?
Yeah, the place that I'd mainly wanted to see was my old base, which is was a battalion base west of Da Nang called Hill 10. And it was just amid the last rice paddies just before the mountains began. It was this great big base sort of on the top of a hill, and we went back to it. And I had all these expectations for what it would be like. And we drove up the road and around the sort of bend and through the trees. And there, where it was supposed to be, was nothing. There was nothing there, just a sort of red gash on the hill. And I was so stunned, because my memory had just had this whole base on top of this hill, and there was nothing there. And so I had to just sort of wander around and imagine it all over. You know, there was no barbed wire, no nothing, just sort of the rice paddies and silence. And that experience happened over and over again. Everywhere I went where there had been sort of major landmarks of the war, there was nothing left. It was as if the war had never happened. It was as if we had never been there. It was very strange.
You met two women who, in their own way, are symbols of some of the worst things that Americans did in Vietnam. You met the woman who was pictured in every newspaper
Life
in America,
magazine.
I think. Yeah, but it was reproduced all
That's
over,
right.
too. And it was the picture of the young girl running who had just been napalmed, and she's holding her hands up, and flesh is kind of torn off of her. Of her chest. And you also met a woman who was perhaps the, or at least one of the only survivors of the My Lai massacre. Did these two women survivors have any idea of what their lives have come to symbolize to Americans?
Well, Kim Phuc, who is the woman who was burned with napalm, certainly did, because she's like a folk hero in Vietnam and has been to Europe and sort of by her suffering become a world figure. And she's a quiet young woman of 20 who wants to be a doctor. And Vo Thi Linh, who is a My Lai survivor, is much less well known, but the massacre which she witnessed and survived is sort of a metaphor now for brutality and all that. And meeting both of them had a tremendous impact on me. I mean, their tears were streaming down their faces as they were talking to me. And all I could say was I was sorry. I was so sorry this had happened. On the other hand, I myself saw numerous cases in which the people we were fighting, the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese, would blow up an entire village and kill everyone there. I mean, I remember going to an orphanage, a Buddhist orphanage, where they had bayoneted all the orphans and the nuns taking care of them. I mean, horrible, terrible things. It was a very brutal war on both sides. The difference is that I think we have in some ways had to struggle with My Lai and Vo Thi Linh and Kim Phuc's napalm burn body. And to them, the people that destroyed the orphanage and killed the nuns are heroes. We should feel nothing but guilt and shame about what happened at My Lai. I think it is a terrible mark on our record and on our history. But the fact that we do feel that, I think, speaks well of us, particularly in comparison to the way in which our enemies have rewritten history about the very same things they did.
My guest is William Broyles. And he fought in Vietnam in 1968 as a lieutenant in the Marines. In 1984, after he'd served as an editor at Texas Monthly Magazine and an editor-in-chief at Newsweek, he decided to return to Vietnam, and he spent 4 weeks there and has written a book about his experiences there and his reflections on the war. The book is called Brothers in Arms. Did you feel... well, let me ask you one more thing. You spoke to a lot of generals who were in Vietnam, and one of them said to you, well, there's a lesson to be learned here. It's easier to start a war than to end a war. What's the significance to you of that comment?
Well, to me, that was one of the most sort of profound things I was told. I mean, it came at the end of a long sort of series of talks with people about why we lost and all that. And I think, to me, it means is that that the military and starting a war is really truly the last resort of a society. And once you begin the process of war, it's very difficult to end it until you either win or lose. The trouble with Vietnam is we didn't know what it was to win or to lose.
You left with a sympathy for the Vietnamese who had been your enemy that you, I think, were unprepared to feel. You didn't, I think, expect to feel that. Is that right? Were you unprepared for that?
Right. I didn't think I would. I mean, I thought I would be curious and I would learn things, but I didn't expect the sort of spontaneous emotional connection I had with them. And it was not that different from what I feel when I meet an American Vietnam veteran that I hadn't known, who I hadn't known before. Because it's like this instant connection. We speak the same language. I sort of trust him. If I meet an American who served in Vietnam and I've never met him, I automatically trust him more than anyone else. I ended up feeling that way about the ordinary men I fought against. I didn't feel that way so much about the generals and the politicians because they're very manipulative, very ideological, very committed to a sort of narrow worldview that's very different from mine and repugnant to it. But the ordinary people that fought out in the rice paddies with me, against me, I had tremendous respect for and a sort of instant rapport with.
You conclude in your book that men love war in a way, and that you hate war, but that you had to just come to terms with the fact at some point that although you hate war, that there was something you missed about it, and there's something that you loved about it in very strange and troubling ways. Can you explain how that realization kind of bubbled up to the surface?
Well, it happened after I had been down to the memorial in 82, and I sought out some of my old platoon members. And when we got together, we ended up laughing and recalling things that had happened and remembering how much we had depended on each other and how much we'd loved each other and what we were willing to risk for each other. And it was in such contrast to our lives as they were now, when we were all out for each other, out for ourselves, when daily life had a kind of routine and selfishness to it, that war didn't. I mean, there you were with a group of men alone, and you were totally dependent upon each other. I mean, for a lot of these people, it was the one and only time in their lives in which they truly counted, in which the things they did that day at that moment meant everything. We're part of history. And it's that sort of intensity, I think, that men who or women who know war remain nostalgic about all their lives. Just as this sort of horror and vision of death and destruction that goes with it also stays in their mind all their lives. And it's hard. People want things to be cut and dried. You know, they want to say war is horrible, I hate it, or what. But it's not that simple. I mean, it's quite possible to and common to have both feelings about it, to have this kind of revulsion for the horrible brutality of it and the death, but then to also think that this was a sort of moment in which I had these qualities that I was proud of, that I was unselfish, that I had some courage, that I was loyal, that my life counted. People could count on me. And I loved all that, and I miss it. I don't want to recreate it. I mean, I don't want to go out and be in another war, and I certainly don't want, you know, I don't think we should create wars to give men this experience. But having talked to the Viet Cong, they had the same feeling. And I suspect that it's feelings that certainly World War II veterans have. But they've been allowed to have it. I mean, it's perfectly fine for World War II veterans to sort of get together and tell stories and have camaraderie, and because they were fighting the good war and they won. And it seemed kind of unseemly through the 70s for us Vietnam veterans to do that, because we were kind of unclean and morally suspect, which I think was ridiculous. And it took us almost 10 years to get over that.
Do you think that feeling, as it gets interpreted in movies and in some novels, ends up inspiring new wars because people end up thinking of all of the camaraderie and want to experience that too?
Well, I don't know. It may be. I'm not saying it's not, but on the other hand, I grew up with Audie Murphy and John Wayne, but Vietnam War wasn't my idea. I mean, John Wayne didn't send me to Vietnam. Richard Nixon did. And it isn't the problem that young men kind of grew up with heroes and myths. The problem is when old men believe them. I mean, people my age are supposed to know better, and I think I would. And I'm not talking about how I feel today. I'm talking about my memories of how I felt then. I don't think that these sort of heroic myths, I think every culture has them. The Vietnamese certainly do. And I think my parents and my grandparents did. The problem is that we need to have leaders who can understand the difference between our real national interests and our imagined ones.
I'm sure you've read the articles by Christopher Buckley and by Bob Green saying that they didn't fight in Vietnam, and in a way they will always be sorry about that, because they know that their peers who did fight got to experience something about manhood, about their own character, about how they really behave under fire and under stress, and that they'll always be kind of fuller human beings and better men for it. And I wonder what your reactions were to those pieces.
Well, it makes me laugh. I mean, where were they when we were out in the jungle? I mean, it's easier to say that now that you're past draft age. I think that, in a way, is more dangerous than the honest feelings of men who actually know war. It's the romantic visions of war by people who don't know it that are truly the truly dangerous ones. Ronald Reagan knows nothing of war, our president. I mean, he was made training films in World War II, but he has a sort of romantic vision of it. Sylvester Stallone was at a girls' school in Switzerland during the war, and he has this very romantic, brutal vision of war. That a lot of the people in the government today who are sort of my age and who are real hawks on Central America and elsewhere were, you know, dodged the draft and weren't in Vietnam. I find that the people I know who were Vietnam veterans to be much less quick on the trigger, so far as let's send the Marines in, than the people who weren't in the war. I think they have much less romantic views about war than people who didn't fight there. And I really do think that the feelings I'm talking about, that are the honest memories of war by people who know it, to me are much less dangerous than these romantic feelings that Chris Buckley and Bob Green have. You know, and to me, I think they should just keep their mouths shut. You know, I really do. I like the writing. I think they're both good writers. But, I mean, on this particular issue, I mean, I just write about something else.
When you went to Vietnam for that second time, when you went in 1984, you had thought that you'd put the war behind you, but you realized you actually hadn't. And you were still having some recurring nightmares about the war. Did the experience of returning to Vietnam purge you of any of that?
Oh, yeah. In fact, the basic dream that I had, which was of returning to my old base and being ambushed right in the shadow of the base and nobody hearing. And you could see all the men on the base going about their daily work and taking showers, and we were getting blown away right under their nose. And I kept having that dream. But when I went back there and saw that same place and the base was gone and the tree line where we're ambushed from is peaceful and the rice paddies are there, I saw all that, and once I'd seen it, I never had that dream again. I haven't had it since. I used to have these visions of going down into a tunnel, which is how the book begins, of going down into a tunnel during the war and to blow it up and encountering a presence of someone who I think was another soldier, an enemy down there. I used to think about that a lot. When I finally went back down into a tunnel in Vietnam on this trip, I stopped thinking about that too. It really was, having seen it as it is now, it overlaid those memories with a new reality, and it really kind of pushed them away. I mean, I may have the dreams again, but I haven't in the last 2 years.
And do you feel like you've put the war behind you now?
I don't know if you ever put it completely behind you. I mean, it's like it was a major experience in my life, and I've come to see it as something which has given me a source of strength, as well as and it's been a kind of solace to me, as well as something which I just wanted to forget. I'm not sure I want to put it behind me in the sense that I want to forget it, but it's helped me remember it in a sort of constructive way, and it's helped me purge myself of the sort of whatever legacy of feelings I had of confusion, doubt, hate, whatever. And I feel sort of like that woman said, whose husband I might have killed. That was the war is over, life goes on. I mean, very simple statements, but they really, when I finally heard them in that situation, they meant something very important to me.
That was William Broyles, author of the book Brothers in Arms, A Journey from War to Peace, published by Knopf. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineers for this edition were Ron Barron and Joyce Lieberman. The show is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Sallet is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I are the producers of the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible in part with funds provided by Philadelphia-based Cigna Corporation, a provider of insurance and related financial services to businesses and individuals worldwide. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.